Aloha. Welcome to Island Issues, a weekly program exploring Hawaii Island's issues, problems, and solutions. Now, here's your host, Sherry Bracken.
Aloha. Good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. We're here every Sunday, 6:30 a.m. Koa Country, 107.7 FM, 8 a.m. Lava, 105.3 FM. Today is part two of brain trauma. Last week, we talked with Dr. Teresa Wang. She's a Hawaii Island resident who was in a terrible car crash in November 2010 when a young woman driving south on Queen Kaʻomano Highway with her boyfriend crossed over the center line and crashed head-on into Dr. Wang's car. Dr. Wang had 28 broken bones, severe brain trauma. Today, nearly 3 years after the accident, she is far better, but not perfect. And we talked with Dr. Wang about the process of getting back to closer to normal. I have to say that Dr. Wang is sort of a poster child for brain trauma recovery because she is pretty amazing with great capacity for speech. She has a sense of humor. She is physically not the way she was before, but getting back, although her memory is still impaired, she says. But today we'll understand more about that process. Our guest today is Dr. Mark Ashley, who runs the Brain Trauma Rehab Center in California, where Dr. Wang spent about 7 months in intensive rehabilitation therapy, which she said, by the way, was far more difficult than going to medical school. You may listen to part one of Brain Trauma, our conversation with Dr. Teresa Wang, and other previous Island Issues interviews online at BigIslandNewsCenter.com. They're down on the right. I recorded this conversation with Dr. Ashley when I went to California a couple months ago. We were at his brain trauma rehab facility in Encino, which is part of Los Angeles, where he and his team work with brain trauma patients of all ages, from child to older. And now to our conversation with Dr. Mark Ashley. Dr. Ashley is the co-founder and president and CEO of the Center for NeuroSkills, which has operated post-acute brain injury rehabilitation programs at facilities in Bakersfield, California, Encino, California, that's in Los Angeles, and Irving, Texas since 1978. Dr. Ashley is very involved with brain trauma and brain injury and is on boards and on committees that deal with the issues. Dr. Ashley received his master's degree in speech pathology and a doctorate of science from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, Illinois. He's currently an adjunct professor at the university's Department of Communication Disorders and Sciences in the College of Education, specializing in brain injury and cognitive deficits. Dr. Ashley is a licensed speech-language pathologist in California and in Texas. He's a certified case manager and certified brain injury specialist trainer. And we're talking at his office in Encino, California. Dr. Ashley, aloha.
Aloha. Welcome to California.
I'm glad to be here. And I'm really curious, what really sparked your interest in brain trauma and brain trauma rehabilitation?
Well, in 1972, I was 14 or 15 years of age, and my brother sustained a brain injury while in the Navy. So that would be my first exposure to brain injury. I would then go off to school, and in my graduate program, I was involved in the startup of what would then be the first post-acute rehabilitation project for people with brain injury in the country. So those roots from 1972 through the startup of that program, which would have been in 1977, been doing this quite a little while.
Dr. Ashley, one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about the whole issue of brain trauma, of course, is sparked by the well-publicized accident that really damaged Dr. Teresa Wang. And one of the things that is very unfortunate about Hawaii Island is we have the highest rate of deaths from injury from car crashes due to impaired driving. And we talk a lot about the deaths that result from those kind of accidents, but what we don't really talk about are those people who don't die. And Dr. Wang really brought that to the forefront.
Although in her case, there's no indication that the driver of the car that slammed into her was impaired by drugs or alcohol, it really reminded us that you can be in a terrible crash, not die, but suffer amazingly awful consequences.
First, I want to ask you, what exactly is brain trauma? What does that mean?
Well, brain trauma refers to damage to the brain that's the result of force transmitted across the structures of the brain. So it can be trauma from a fall, from a motor vehicle accident, being struck by or against something,
What's the primary cause of brain trauma?
The primary cause is falls. The second most common cause would be motor vehicle accidents.
I couldn't find specific statistics for the state of Hawaii, although KITV television reported that we have in the state between 2,000 and 3,000 cases per year of brain trauma. Any idea nationally how much brain trauma there is?
Sure. We have general statistics that put the rates of injury between 100 and 300 per 100,000. There are additional statistics, however, that are out that help us to understand mild traumatic brain injury or concussion. And what we have to remember is that the majority of injuries are actually concussion-type injuries. So about 25% of all traumatic brain injuries would be in the moderate to severe range, and that would be the kind of injury that Dr. Huang experienced. If we look at mild traumatic brain injury, however, the incidence is actually as much as 600 per 100,000, and we believe that that's an underestimate. So in large numbers across the U.S., what we find is that all traumatic brain injury, and traumatic brain injury being what we defined earlier, combined with acquired brain injury, which would be in large measure strokes, we'll see that the incidence of acquired brain injury, the larger category, is 3 to 4 times more prevalent than all new diagnoses of cancer in the U.S. annually.
Interesting, acquired brain injury being stroke, right?
Yes, it's stroke. It's conditions that arise from other sorts of etiologies, infectious, toxic, metabolic, neoplastic kinds of injuries in addition to vascular and traumatic injuries.
Would what I would call the symptoms of brain injury be similar for somebody who had a stroke compared to somebody who had, say, Dr. Wang's situation of being hit by a car and severely injured that way?
Well, a stroke can certainly be as severe in its presentation as Dr. Huang's injury. Generally speaking, what we look at is the part of the brain that's injured and the way in which it's injured. So a stroke can be a more focal injury, a small part of the brain that's injured, or it can be a massive stroke. Whereas a traumatic brain injury impacts generally not only in a specific region of the brain, but multiple regions of the brain.
If one has brain trauma, what are the symptoms? What are the results? What are the impacts to that person?
Well, it's a good question. Unfortunately, it's not a simple answer. Because the brain controls virtually everything that a human being experiences and a human being does, the sequela, the results of an injury, really can vary considerably with the individual. So if you and I were to have the same injury caused the same way with the same amount of force, because we have different educational backgrounds, we have different life experiences, we have different genetic makeups, we might very well present with quite different clinical pictures. In large terms, our picture might be the same. We might both have a paralyzed arm or leg, or both. But in terms of our other skills and abilities, our cognitive skills, our psychological issues, our behavioral manifestations, all of those sorts of things, they may vary considerably between the two of us.
You know, you mentioned, for example, brain trauma could cause my arm to not function properly. How do you, as a doctor, tell the difference? And I'll use Dr. Teresa Wang as an example. She had, I believe, 28 broken bones, including all of her limbs. She also had brain trauma. As a doctor looks at, for example, the ability of her arm to recover, how do they know if it's the brain or the actual physical break that is causing her problem?
Well, the break is a mechanical problem, whereas the ability to move the arm and have sensation in the arm is an electrical problem. It's a nerve problem. So the nerves, unless the nerves happen to be disconnected in some way by the break, which is unusual, but certainly possible, we typically are then looking at a central nervous system sort of problem. So that can be either the spinal cord or the brain, and in Dr. Wang's case, it was the brain. So the brain is organized in a way that we can predict, in some measure, the nature of the injury that's likely to arrive from a particular kind of injury. We know that there are sensory regions of the brain, there are motor regions of the brain. We know the left side of the brain controls the right side of the body, those kinds of straightforward relationships. And so when we see a patient and how the extremities are involved or how the body is involved, it's pretty straightforward to determine that the injury is most likely arising from the brain injury and not from the orthopedic.
So if somebody has a brain injury, can you look at something like an MRI or a CAT scan and see exactly what the injury is so you can sort of understand what the problems are going to be or are?
It's a good question, and the problem that we have is resolution. So if you take a picture of something with your camera, and we know that cameras have different resolutions, sometimes what you see doesn't show up in the picture. The camera doesn't give all the detail that your eye picks up. The same is the case with a CT scan and an MRI. We know that the CT scan is a very gross measure in comparison to the MRI, but the CT scan can be done on an emergency basis. We don't have to worry too much about metal in the body, and we can discern large lesions with the CT. The MRI is dependent upon the strength of the magnet, and the magnet requires a great deal more time in order to complete the study. An X-ray is much faster. So while there's no X-ray exposure or no radiology exposure with the MRI, it takes longer and we have to be concerned about metal in the body. It provides, however, a much better picture. So the answer is there may be brain damage there that neither of these two instrumentations will show us. The only way that we see what's really there is on autopsy.
That's a little late to be able to fix somebody.
Patients don't tolerate that well.
What is it specifically about a hit to the head that causes one to have symptoms and problems?
Think about brain cells as small computers, and each body's function requires a number of these computers in either isolated regions of the brain or across networks of the brain to function properly. If you think about the subcortical tissues of the brain, those tissues are the wires that connect these computers. So we have to have these individual brain cells or groups of brain cells or networks of brain cells function properly in order to be able to move a finger or move an arm or remember something or learn mathematics or believe in God or any of those kinds of things. So when there's an injury to one of these computers or to many of these computers, you can imagine the function that that computer served will be disrupted. One brain cell connects to up to 10,000 other brain cells. And so this system has a lot of duplicity. There's a lot of interconnectedness. Because of that interconnectedness, if we lose some cells, we can often find pathways that are present that we can utilize for function due to this duplicity. So when we lose a function, one of a couple of different things will happen. Either the brain will find one of these alternate pathways, which happens fairly early on, or the brain will reorganize itself so that other cells learn the function and take it over, or the brain will grow new structures to be able to acquire or reacquire that function.
You said the brain can reestablish new pathways. Can it do that all by itself, or does it need the help that is provided by rehab, for example?
You're very intuitive. You're asking questions that I wish many of my colleagues would ask. In fact, what the brain does is entirely dependent upon demand from the environment. Now, the environment constitutes not only what goes on outside our bodies, but also what goes on within the brain. So the brain can, in fact, create demand for itself. But in simple terms, you can look at perhaps an ability to, or a desire rather, to learn a particular language. In Hawaii, there are many, many languages spoken, and one would be well served to know them all. You can't just decide you want to learn them, however, and all of a sudden you know them. It doesn't work that way. If you look at immersion programs for language, they increase the demand for learning by requiring that the individual speak only the language that they're wishing to acquire. What happens is the acquisition of the language is better, faster, and more complete. So we have the same kinds of demand created by rehabilitation in medical settings, and that rehabilitation is what reprograms existing structures or calls for new structures to be created and then to be programmed.
Dr. Teresa Wang had had a stroke previously. She was actually 2 weeks away from going back to her job as a physician. Did her prior stroke impact the way her brain injury presented itself? Was that a factor in her situation at all?
Absolutely. You've got to remember the brain is a limited or finite resource. So her first injury, she lost structure, she lost tissue, she lost capacity. She had recovered well and was in the process of returning to work when the second injury occurred and took more resources, took more tissue. So the good story for Dr. Wang is that she's a very intelligent person. And the more intelligent a person is, the better they can recover from a brain injury. The better education they have, the better they can recover. And they're pretty much assessing the same kind of thing. So in her instance, she had two injuries superimposed on a really fine instrument that was her intellectual capability. But without doubt, the previous injury and the second injury are additive or cumulative.
A reminder, this is Island Issues, and I'm your host, Sherry Bracken. This is part two of Brain Trauma. We're talking with Dr. Mark Ashley, who runs a series of brain trauma rehab centers in California and Texas. Last week, part one was with Dr. Teresa Wang, who was a victim of brain trauma and numerous other injuries when her car was slammed into in November 2010. Before we go back to our interview, I want to let you know that I did promise you an update on the status of any legal case against the driver of the other car. Last week, we learned from Dr. Wang that she had received an out-of-court settlement in that case from the driver of that car, Shakti Stream, a Kona resident whose passenger in the car was former UH quarterback Colt Brennan. But last Monday, Dale Ross, deputy county prosecutor, said they have not yet resolved the case from the prosecutor's standpoint. The statute of limitations expires in November 2013, and at that point, they will have to make a decision. Now, back to Dr. Mark Ashley, with whom we spoke in his office in Encino, California. Speech is a fundamental essence of our ability to function in society today, and it seems like whether it's stroke or brain trauma, a lot of times people's speech is impacted in some way. Now, Dr. Wang said that she was told, she does not remember, but she was told by the paramedics that she was talking a lot right at the scene of the accident. But a lot of people lose their ability to talk. So why is that specifically in brain damage?
Why do they lose their ability? Well, it depends on the type of brain injury, where the brain was injured. So in the left frontal region, we have structures that are responsible, it's called Broca's area, for the ability to produce speech motorically. In the temporal region, we have an area called Wernicke's area, which is responsible for our ability to understand language, spoken word. So these two areas have to communicate in order for an individual to A, understand what's being said, and B, produce language themselves. If one of those areas is impaired at the time of an injury or following an injury, the person's going to lose this ability. It's interesting because while the ability to produce speech may be intact, the linguistic content of what's being said may not be. So the person can be speaking and be very confused. The person can be telling you one thing that's absolutely not real, not true, but they completely believe what they're telling you. They may also produce speech that's completely unintelligible. You can't understand what they're saying. And so it depends. They can be aphonic, unable to produce any voice. They can be aphasic in several different ways, unable to understand what's being said to them, unable to make themselves understood, or a combination of the two.
It seems that one thing that sometimes happens in brain injury is that people either do not express emotion appropriately or they express a lot of anger. Is that from the physical trauma? Is that from frustration? Why is anger and inappropriate emotion sometimes a part of brain trauma?
Well, remember, the frontal lobes are primarily responsible for putting the brakes on. So if you think about a difficult social situation, perhaps a thought comes to mind about a person in that social circumstance. You inhibit the thought from being spoken. If you don't have the brakes put on, then you say it. We see that behavior enhanced when a person uses alcohol as an example. Alcohol drops inhibitions. It disengages some of those frontal lobe structures. Well, when we have an injury to those structures, it's a similar kind of phenomenon. So yes, there is, in fact, a psychological contribution for some individuals. They are able to remember that what they were able to do before the injury is very different from what they're able to do now. Maybe half their body doesn't work. Maybe they were able to walk and now they're not able to. Maybe they were continent of bowel and bladder and maybe they've lost that continence and now someone has to help them in the bathroom. Perhaps they were working and now they're not working. They were making a living and now they're not making a wage. They have the unfortunate reality that they can remember what was about their lives and they can compare where they are to what they had and they can appreciate that loss. Not all patients can, but many can. So there is that emotional component. But apart from that, we have this neurologic component that is about being able to put the brakes on. When we lose this impulse control, now the individual does act, and it appears as though those behaviors are in fact inappropriate.
Dr. Ashley, what is the treatment for brain trauma?
I wish it were that simple. The most effective treatments are those treatments that combine the few pharmacologic agents that we are able to use successfully with allied health disciplines or therapies. So the brain has to have this externally induced demand. The environment has to demand function, and the brain will respond to that. So we have to structure all of the engagement with a patient in a day to reacquire skill sets. Those skill sets may be as basic as being able to go to the bathroom, being able to know that you have to go to the bathroom and get to a bathroom to use the bathroom before you have an accident. It can be as basic as learning to eat again, learning to speak and make sense, learning to remember or to pay attention, to dress yourself, to walk. Anything that the human body does or a human being does is vulnerable. Fortunately, much of the brain has this experience contained within it, and we don't lose it all. And we see bits and pieces of it coming back, and we can use those bits and pieces to shape an individual's engagement in their environment and teach what they don't have. However, there are some instances where we have to reteach all of those skills. And so just like you had to learn your mathematics by learning numbers first, then addition, simple addition, then complicated addition, and so on, we have to structure all of the involvement that we undertake with a patient. Brain cells don't care what they learn. Brain cells only care about acquiring function or not. And so we have to be careful, and this is called adaptive plasticity, we have to be careful about what it is we present to the brain cells in terms of demand, because that's what they'll acquire. When patients aren't given the opportunity to get into the right structured therapies, those brain cells will undertake maladaptive plasticity. And this is where you see the emergence of asocial behaviors, some of the anger that you mentioned, the irritability, the acting out, or inappropriate motor patterns that won't allow the patient to walk properly, or speech patterns, or just about anything else. So we control what the brain is exposed to, and we control how it reacquires those skills and the order in which it reacquires those skills through the rehabilitation.
You mentioned drugs. What kind of drugs would you use in this kind of situation, brain trauma?
Well, the brain operates on a biochemical system. Substances are referred to as neurotransmitters or neuromodulators, at least in part. And we do have some medications that when a neurotransmitter system is depleted, or when cells in that system have been lost, we can use some of these drugs to promote function of that system. So we can manipulate in the grossest of ways. We don't have finite tools yet, but we can manipulate the dopamine system, the norepinephrine and epinephrine systems, the catecholamine system and the serotonin system, and to a lesser degree, the acetylcholine system, so the system that's involved in learning.
Dr. Wang mentioned that she had taken several different drugs, and I would say these were off-label uses for the drugs in many cases. How do you figure out what drug to use with a brain trauma patient? Because the way Dr. Wang described it, in a way, it's a little bit trial and error.
She's absolutely correct. There have been no drugs developed in the last 3 decades specifically to treat traumatic brain injury. Unfortunately, the brain is a biochemical stew, and we are in our infancy in understanding all of its ingredients and how they interact with one another. In fact, in our research endeavors, we have failed in over 20 different drug trials, thinking that we are onto something and finding out that we were not, because the animals that we're able to utilize mice, rodents, respond differently than humans do. So unfortunately, we have no defined medications. That said, there are medications that are in fact used in an off-label fashion by virtue of the clinician's review of the patient's presentation and an informed estimation of the patient's likely response to those medications. And we know some things not to do. So, for example, one of the medications that we will use to facilitate motor learning and motor recovery and a number of other areas, it can be impactful for language recovery and so on, is methylphenidate or Ritalin. But we know that if a patient has a great deal of spasticity, that it will also encourage the spastic response, and so that medication is not a medication of choice for that individual. So there are those kinds of drug options that we have that will work with some patients, will not work with others, and for every patient, it's always a trial and error sort of approach because we don't know how each patient's brain is going to respond to the introduction of one of these agents, and we don't know the degree to which that patient's blood-brain barrier has been altered or has restored itself.
Brain trauma treatment is not a simple thing, is it?
Yeah, you're right. It's one of the most complicated areas. Think about it. The brain is the body's most exquisitely complex organ. We are in our, as I said earlier, our infancy in understanding it. And the challenge is that every patient brings to you a different constellation of issues and problems. None of them come to you divorced of their life history. So all of that information, all of that baggage, if you will, comes as well. There's good baggage and there's baggage that's not so good, all of which has to be factored into the rehabilitation of that individual. In rehabilitation, our charge is to get the patient back to who they were. That means all of the trials and tribulations, all of the wonderful things in our lives contribute to who we are at the moment of injury. Our genetics contribute, and then, of course, the nature of the injury. So it's often said that no two brain injuries are alike, and that really is the case.
In Dr. Wang's case, she was treated at Queens Medical Center for her traumatic injuries for about 7 weeks. She then went to a rehab center in Denver, and then she went to your rehab center here in California. Is it possible for a brain trauma injury patient such as Dr. Wang or any other person to get the kind of brain trauma rehab they might need in the state of Hawaii? Is there a facility in our state that exists to do what your centers here in California and Texas do?
Well, let me start at the broader level. The treatment that's available in Hawaii, i.e. Queens Medical Center, is state-of-the-art. I've seen a number of patients' records from the facility. I've seen the work that the staff there does. It's nothing short of phenomenal. They do tremendous work. One of the challenges, however, is the state's geography. So the timing that it takes for a patient to get to trauma care for these catastrophic injuries contributes to the complications of their condition. From there, the hospital that you mentioned in Colorado is an acute rehabilitation hospital. We do have an acute rehabilitation hospital in Honolulu, and that's Rehabilitation Hospital of the Pacific. They do fine work as well. The distinction between the two would be the complexity of the patient. In Dr. Wang's case, looking at her medical diagnosis, there were some 28 major medical diagnostic categories to describe her condition. You mentioned 28 fractures. They're not the 28 I'm talking about. This woman was very, very severely injured. And so the facility in Colorado happens to deal with these very complex cases. Now, insofar as Center for Neuroskills kind of treatment is concerned, no, that kind of treatment is not available in the islands.
At this point, we're going to stop the interview because we are out of time. There are a lot of significant questions still to be answered, such as, what kind of insurance covers all this kind of brain trauma rehab? We will get that information as well as more information about what is actually done in brain trauma rehab next week on Island Issues. I'm your host, Sherry Bracken. Today we've been talking with Dr. Mark Ashley at his facility at the Center for Neuroskills in Encino, California. Last week, we talked with brain trauma victim Dr. Teresa Wang. That interview and this one are online, BigIslandNewsCenter.com, down on the right. We'll see you next Sunday for another Island Issues. Until then, let's spread aloha around Hawaii Island, and please, especially, let's drive with aloha. Ahui ho.
Thank you for joining us for Island Issues. We welcome your suggestions and input. Please visit our website, islandissues.com. Email us at info@islandissues.com. Join us next week at the same time for another edition of Island Issues. Island Issues is a public affairs presentation of Mahalo Broadcasting.